May the written word and the spoken word lead us to the living word. In the name of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen. You may be seated. I will confess to being a little suspicious that the internet just happened to go out right before the sermon. However, I think it really was an accident, and we're really grateful for all who have been able to find us again. We don't want to make it too easy for you. But we're glad that you found us and that you're here again. And those who have not been able to continue to watch in real time, I hope you'll tune in a little later and you'll be able to see this then. On Friday, Linda and I ordered takeout from a local restaurant. I phoned in the order and gave them my name over the phone, Steve Bateman. I thought that I had said it clearly. When I arrived for pickup, they had trouble finding the order, and after a whole lot of consultation among the staff, a little bit of whispering back and forth, one of them finally handed me a bag of food, and I could see that there was some writing on the side of the bag, but they handed it to me so that I couldn't see the writing, and that made me curious. So as soon as I got out of the restaurant, I, of course, had to look, and there, written in felt-tipped marker, was the name Eve Bakerman. Now, I don't regard myself as thin-skinned, but there's something about a name, isn't there? We all want to be known, and one of the ways we are known is by our name. And I will admit that going from Steve Bateman to Eve Bakerman was a bit off-putting. What we call ourselves, what we are called, it's important. As I spent time in our Easter Gospel this week, I saw something that I hadn't noticed before, though having read it dozens of times. I was drawn to three different occasions when names are used in a rather unusual way in this passage. First, there is a missing name in verse 2. Then there is a spoken name in verse 16. And then there is a changed name in verse 17, and all three of these important moments help us to understand the implications of Jesus' resurrection for us personally and for the church as a whole. So the missing name in verse 3, in verse 2 rather, tells us something about identity. And the spoken name in verse 16 tells us something about relationship. And the changed name in verse 17 tells us something about mission. But first, before we get there, let's set the stage. In her Good Friday sermon, Gillian Breckenridge invited us to view the cross not retrospectively from the perspective of Easter Sunday, but on its own terms, as a moment, as rather more of a singular event. She invited us to try to see the death of Jesus through the eyes of the disciples. I quote, "Jesus was their teacher. They had left their lives and livelihoods behind to follow him. They had seen him heal the sick, feed the hungry. They expected that he would bring the kingdom that they had been waiting for. His presence was nothing less than the presence of God to them, and he was their friend." She goes on, "I wonder if they questioned themselves, if they questioned Jesus, his teaching. I wonder if they felt foolish about the hope they had had in Jesus." End quote. I can only imagine that the disciples experienced all of these things. There is no doubt that they were gutted by Jesus' death. They had invested their lives in following him, and now they had wondered if they had made a huge mistake. Had the last 3 years of their lives been an exercise in futility? Well, John chapter 20 is about to give us God's definitive answer to that question. We pick up the account with Mary Magdalene. Early on, before it's light, she goes to the tomb. She's not been able to travel the day before due to Sabbath restrictions, which in that place and that time were kept as carefully as any COVID quarantine rule. But now it was Sunday. It was the first day of the week, and she was anxious to visit the tomb. To her surprise, the stone had been rolled away. Now, to those who are inclined to believe that the resurrection accounts can be chalked up to hysterical people jumping to conclusions, Please note that her first thought was not that Jesus had been raised from the dead. At this point, that doesn't even seem to have entered her mind. Her first instinct was actually a sort of aggrieved frustration. She seems to think it may have been some kind of a mix-up, that they had, for some reason, put him in a different tomb. Maybe in the back of her mind, she may have had concerns about grave robbers. This was a common issue in the first century in this place, common enough to have required the enactment of a special decree from the Roman emperor himself, right around this time, possibly a little later. You can almost hear her thinking, what? Still more chaos after all we have been through already. In any case, she went to get help to try to sort it all out. The next moments in the account involve a lot of running. Mary runs to get the disciples. Peter and John run back to the tomb. And here is where we find our first unusual moment. Here is our missing name. John, who is traditionally identified as the author of this gospel, does not use his proper name. Instead, six times throughout the gospel, he refers to himself only as the disciple whom Jesus loved. Why does this little detail matter? Because it tells us something about John. It tells us about how he was known. It tells us something about how he wanted to be known. It tells us that as he looked back on these events years later, this identity was more important to him than even his own name. What was his identity? He was the one that was loved by Jesus. This became his North Star. This is his reference point. This is what makes his life make sense to him. To know that we are loved is powerful. To know that we are loved by the one who created us, the one who died for us, and the one who rose again is completely transformative. And this is the confidence that John in his later years came to have. Now contrast this with the younger John, asking Jesus to let him sit on his right or left hand in his kingdom, grasping for significance and for power. His encounters with the resurrected Lord transformed him into the disciple whom Jesus loved. So Peter and John, they arrive at the tomb, but instead of clearing things up, the mystery only deepens. The expensive linens, which were usually the main target of grave robbers, were sitting inside the tomb. The body was gone, but the linens were still there. It made no sense. How were they neatly folded as though the body had sort of just vanished from within them? How could this happen? Ancient commentators also note that the myrrh and other spices that were used, as much as sometimes 75 pounds of spices, when combined with the corpse and the grave clothes, made these linen strips notoriously hard to remove. So how are these cloths sitting there, neatly folded, the body nowhere to be found? Well, they were at a loss to explain it. They puzzled over it for a while, and then they returned home. Perhaps Peter was still nervous about being out in the open, out in public, after his close call with the authorities just a short few days earlier. But Mary stays. She is disconsolate. She is alone. She weeps. She looks inside the tomb again and sees two angels dressed in white sitting there, and then sees a third person behind her. She thinks he is the gardener. Perhaps she was relieved. Finally, someone with some knowledge or authority who can clear this up. Sir, she says, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away. The gardener answers by speaking her name, Mary. Imagine what it might have been like to hear that familiar voice say your name. Here is our second unusual moment. This is the name spoken. This is a remarkable exchange. Well-known commentator C.H. Dodd says that there is something undeniably firsthand about this account. He suggests that there is, in fact, nothing quite like this in all of ancient literature. Here is a rabbi tenderly calling a woman's name, it is a deeply personal moment. And it is only when she hears her name that she realizes that she is talking to Jesus. Rabboni, dear teacher, she says, and she clings to him. It is a powerful and very important thing to have your name called by the one who just conquered death. Can you imagine the flood of emotions, the complete reversal that would have happened in just a single moment? In this respect, Mary is so like you and me. We too can live with the assurance that we are known, that there is someone in the universe who will never get our name wrong. Is this not one of our great fears, to be unknown, to be unseen? But in the resurrected Christ, we are offered a relationship with God, a way to be both seen and known by the one who created us and gave himself for us. So the account continues. Mary tells Jesus to stop clinging to him. He has a job for her. He wants her to go and take care of something for him. She is to be the first apostle, the first sent one. She is to tell the others that she has seen Jesus, and so she actually becomes an apostle to the apostles. And she's given a very specific message, and in this message is our third unusual moment. Here we see a changed name. Jesus says, go and tell my brothers. Now note here, he does not use the term disciples or followers. For the first time in this gospel, he uses the term brothers. He goes on, I am ascending to my Father and to your Father, to my God and to your God. Now, up until now, it has always been the Father or the Father who sent me or my Father. But here's a change. Now it's my Father and your Father. So how do they so suddenly go from being disciples or followers to being brothers? N.T. Wright puts it like this. Something has altered decisively. Something has been achieved. A new relationship has sprung to life like a sudden spring flower. The disciples are welcomed into a new world, a world where they can know God the way Jesus knew God, where they can be intimate children with their Father. A New Testament scholar, Bruce Milne, says, whereas Jesus' relationship to the Father has been a holy ground that the disciples might not tread upon or even approach, his death and rising open a new relationship with the Holy One. He is now also their Holy Father. Although the relationship between Jesus and the Father would remain forever unique, in a new sense, that special communion between the living God and the man in the flesh, previously the soul preserver of Jesus, is thrown open to them also. So there's this change that happens at this moment. Jesus goes from being the one sent to being the one ascending, and the disciples go from being the ones learning to being the ones sent, the apostles. This is the moment they become the apostles. This is a powerful reminder of the task of the church, the mission of the church. We, after the example of these same apostles, are also sent with the news of this same Jesus, the one who calls our name, the one in whom we find our identity. We are sent with the same mission. We are sent to tell people how he conquered death. We are sent to tell people that they are loved and that they are known. And so it is around the resurrected Jesus that our identity forms. It is with the resurrected Jesus that our most important relationship forms. And it is from the resurrected Jesus that the church receives her most important task. These are three of the biggest questions of our lives. Who am I? Who knows me? Why am I here? All answered in this Easter gospel. May you hear the voice of our risen Lord lovingly calling your name this Easter morning. Thanks be to God.